Welcome to The Debate. You know, when you stand back and look at a massive steel structure, say, the sprawling framework of a skyscraper, or the chassis of a heavy-duty vehicle, there is this profound illusion of stillness.
Right, it looks entirely inert.
Exactly. Solid, completely at peace. But if you zoom in to the atomic level during its creation, you are looking at a landscape of absolute structural violence.
It is anything but peaceful down there.
It really is. It is the frozen aftermath of a war between crystal lattices. Today, we are diving into a metallurgical mystery with a century-long and, frankly, highly checkered history. We are looking closely at the mechanism of the bainite transformation in steel.
Right, and this goes way beyond some academic puzzle. Oh, absolutely. The specific way this microstructure forms, I mean, it fundamentally dictates the strength, the toughness, and the viable creation of modern structural and automotive steels.
Yeah, we're talking about the underlying physics of materials that hold up billion-ton infrastructures globally.
And yet, exactly how bainite physically forms from the parent high-temperature austenite phase, well, it remains one of the most fiercely contested battlegrounds in material science.
Because you have completely opposing camps looking at the exact same metal and drawing fundamentally different conclusions about how the atoms are actually moving.
Which brings us to the central question of our discussion today. Does bainite grow through a purely displacive, diffusionless shear mechanism that is limited strictly by macroscopic thermodynamic boundaries?
Or is its growth governed by localized diffusional processes, partial carbon supersaturation, and mechanical friction right at the transformation interface?
Right. And this debate emerges directly from the Edward DeMille Campbell Memorial Lecture delivered by H.K.D.H. Badeshia, titled Mechanism of the Bainite Transformation, A Turning Point.
The data sets synthesized in that lecture offer us, well, a perfect lens to examine this divide.
So in our exchange today, I will present the case that the transformation is completely diffusionless during its growth phase. It is a purely displacive mechanism, strictly governed by a hard thermodynamic boundary known as the T0 limit.
And I look at this from the opposite angle. To me, saying it is a purely thermodynamic process, it ignores the actual friction of physical reality. I will argue that the transformation fundamentally relies on localized equilibrium, partial supersaturation, and physical mechanical barriers at the phase interface that practically restrict and choke off growth.
Okay, let's establish our foundational frameworks. My position is rooted in the undeniably displacive nature of the transformation.
Sure.
When bainitic ferrite forms from austenite, it does so via what is known as an invariant plane strain shape deformation.
Right, the deck of cards analogy.
Exactly. Imagine cleanly shearing a neatly stacked deck of cards. The cards slide over one another in a coordinated, almost military-like movement.
They don't shuffle.
They don't shuffle. They don't swap places. At the temperatures where bainite forms, there is absolutely no diffusion or mobility of the heavy substitutional atoms.
You mean things like iron, manganese, or silicon?
Yes. The transformation is compositionally invariant during growth. That means carbon, even though it is a highly mobile element, is initially trapped entirely within the newly formed ferrite lattice.
Right.
It only partitions or, you know, bleeds out into the residual austenite after the shear has occurred. Crucially, the growth of these bainite plates ceases the exact moment it becomes thermodynamically impossible, hitting the absolute T0 curve boundary.
Okay, but that macro thermodynamic view is elegant on paper, but it effectively ignores the incredibly complex reality occurring right at the microscopic boundary between those two phases.
I wouldn't say it ignores it.
Well, defining the stop condition purely by a macroscopic thermodynamic limit is incomplete. We have to look at models that account for negligible partitioning local equilibrium, or NPLE.
Ah, the NPLE model.
Yes. We also have to account for partial carbon supersaturation, and perhaps most importantly, the mechanical barriers.
Mechanical barriers.
Right. The advancing interface between austenite and bainitic ferrite isn't just a perfect mathematical plane gliding through empty space.
No one is claiming it's empty space.
But the models often treat it like that. It is a physical boundary grappling with interacting transformation dislocations. As this boundary moves, it faces solute drag and solid solution hardening in the austenite ahead of it.
Okay.
These physical mechanical barriers to interface motion explain the famous incomplete reaction phenomenon, much more realistically than a purely theoretical thermodynamic stop sign.
Well, then, let's dig right into that very boundary. I think the first major area where our frameworks really collide is the mobility of those substitutional solutes, and this concept of negligible partitioning local equilibrium.
Yeah, the NPLE model is vital because it bridges the gap between what we see macroscopically and what must be happening right down at the atomic frontier.
If you say so.
I do. Because even if we do not see large-scale macroscopic partitioning of heavy elements like manganese across the entire phase, local equilibrium can still be maintained right at the growing interface.
Over how much distance? Exactly.
The atoms only need to shift on an infinitesimal scale to satisfy chemical equilibrium locally. And we have empirical data supporting this. Take the experiment on the iron-nitrogen-manganese alloy.
Right, the 500 degrees Celsius one.
Exactly. Specifically, an iron 0.3 weight percent nitrogen, 1 weight percent manganese steel transformed at exactly 500 degrees Celsius. After 10 seconds, you don't see manganese partitioning.
Right.
But if you observe it at 60 seconds, there is a clear, measurable redistribution of manganese right at the phase interface. That definitively proves that localized diffusional activity dictates the phase change. The interface literally has to wait for the heavy atoms to shift locally before it can advance.
Look, I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on what is actually happening with NPLE models and that specific 60-second observation, because I think it's heavily misinterpreted.
Misinterpreted how?
First, we need to look at the mathematical foundation of the NPLE model itself. It relies entirely on a concentration spike of those heavy, substantial solutes just ahead of the advancing interface.
Right, to maintain local equilibrium.
But when we rigorously calculate the physical dimensions of that theoretical spike using highly sophisticated thermodynamic software like Dictra, the results frankly break the laws of physics.
That's a bit dramatic.
It's not. In some steels, the predicted manganese spike is calculated to be between 0.002 and 0.04 nanometers wide.
Which indicates an incredibly sharp local gradient driving the interface.
No, it indicates a physical impossibility. To put that simply for anyone trying to visualize this, an individual atom of iron or manganese is roughly 0.2 to 0.3 nanometers wide.
Okay.
This mathematical model is predicting a chemical gradient, you know, a gradual change in element concentration that occurs over a space nearly 10 times smaller than a single atom.
Well,
you cannot have a concentration gradient inside one atom. Diffusion physically requires an atom to hop from one lattice site to an adjacent empty vacancy. It needs physical space. A subatomic gradient is a mathematical fantasy, not a physical reality.
Look, mathematical models sometimes exhibit extreme edge case outputs, sure, but that doesn't invalidate the principle of local equilibrium happening over the span of a few atomic layers.
But we don't have to rely purely on calculations to disprove it. We have atom probe tomography.
Right.
This isn't theoretical. With atom probe tomography, we can literally rip atoms off a microscopic needle of steel, one by one, using an electric field, and map their exact original positions in three-dimensional space.
It's an amazing technology.
It is. And across dozens of rigorous experiments, looking at interfaces resolved precisely down to the atomic layer, there is absolutely no elemental segregation of heavy solutes at the interface. None. They are perfectly frozen in place.
Okay, but you still have to account for the 60-second manganese redistribution at 500 degrees. That is a measured physical reality, not a mathematical fantasy.
It is a measured reality of a dead plate.
A dead plate?
Yes. That 60-second redistribution is a post-transformation artifact. Bainite grows incredibly fast in subunits. The plate grows. Its growth is eventually arrested by plastic relaxation in the surrounding austenite, and the growth completely stops.
And then what?
If you hold that steel at 500 degrees for 60 seconds, you are simply watching standard sluggish diffusion happening long after the displacive growth phase has finished.
I don't know if I agree that the growth phase is completely finished.
The heavy atoms are just slowly shuffling around a static boundary. It is a post-mortem decay of the interface, not the engine driving the growth.
Well, I come at it from a different way. Even if we discard that specific 60-second redistribution as post-mortem diffusion, we still have to answer the fundamental question of why the plate died in the first place.
Right.
This brings us to the incomplete reaction phenomenon. Why does bainite abruptly stop forming before the steel reaches full thermodynamic equilibrium?
It stops because of the T0 thermodynamic limit, period.
It can't just be that.
It is. This is the absolute point, where the free energy of the newly formed vanadite xerite perfectly equals the free energy of the parent austenite with the exact same chemical composition. It's an inviolable law of thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics, yes, but kinetics matter too.
You cannot physically have a composition invariant transformation if the resulting phase would exist at a higher energy state than the phase it came from.
Right, but...
Let me finish. The Badesha lecture compiles an extraordinary data set. 150 different highly controlled experiments across varying alloys and temperatures. When you plot the average ratio of the actual carbon concentration in the austenite to the calculated T0 concentration at the exact point growth stops, the ratio is exactly one.
Exactly one.
Across 150 experiments, the reaction stops dead exactly at the thermodynamic wall.
Okay, that is a compelling argument, but have you considered that defining the stop condition purely by an absolute limit ignores the mechanics of getting there?
What do you mean?
Relying exclusively on the T0 limit is like assuming a vehicle stops moving only because it perfectly runs out of gas, completely ignoring the fact that it might be driving through increasingly deep mud.
Deep mud? That's your analogy?
It fits. Consider the interface models developed by Ben Raba and his colleagues. They argue that the chemical driving force of the transformation is constantly being eaten away by a very real mechanical barrier.
Yes. A mechanical barrier that is highly problematic to actually calculate.
But conceptually essential for real-world metallurgy. As the interface moves, it isn't gliding through a vacuum.
Obviously not.
It is a dense crystal lattice plowing forcefully into another dense crystal lattice. The back stress of solid solution hardening in the austenite, because carbon is being rejected into it.
Wait, after it forms? Yes.
Combined with the intense dislocation interactions right at the boundary, it creates immense physical friction. This mechanical barrier, this metallurgical mud, reduces the available driving force so significantly that it actually halts the plates from lengthening.
I see.
The thermodynamic T0 line might be out there in the distance, but the plate runs out of mechanical energy and gets bogged down before it can ever reach it.
Look, I must reject the Ben Raba model entirely because it contains a fundamental, fatal contradiction in its own physics.
A fatal contradiction?
Yes. Let's unpack the math there. To calculate this supposed mechanical barrier, the model defines the transformation interface as completely flat, an irrational, open-faced terrace structure acting as a blunt wall.
Right.
But when they try to calculate the actual velocity of the growing plate, they plug in Zener's maximum velocity criterion.
Which is a standard equation for phase growth kinetics. I don't see the problem.
The problem is that Zener's equation is explicitly derived for a sharply curved plate tip. Think of a sharp needle smoothly piercing through the parent metal to calculate speed.
Okay.
You cannot mathematically demand the interface be a perfectly flat wall to generate your high mechanical friction and then simultaneously treat it as a curved piercing needle just to make your velocity calculations work. The geometric compromise destroys the physical premise.
Well, models often have to make geometric compromises to isolate specific variables like interface stress. The underlying principle of interface friction is still valid.
But even if we allow the flat wall geometry, there is a deeper flaw.
Which is?
The localized stresses they're calculating, you know, the disconnections and terraces along this theoretically flat interface, they would actually self-cancel.
Self-cancel?
Yes, because they form a dipole-like structure, alternating positive and negative stress fields. Their long-range stress fields neutralize each other almost immediately.
I'm not sure they neutralize completely.
They do. The actual back stress on the interface drops exponentially faster than their model claims. They are drastically overestimating the friction to try and artificially make their numbers match the stopping point.
Look, even if you contest the specific calculation of the dipole stress, we know empirically that the austenite is hardening as carbon rejects into it. That presents a barrier.
But those mechanical friction models completely fail the ultimate empirical test. They can't predict the martensite start temperature.
Well, martensite is different.
It's still a purely shear mechanism. If you extrapolate their mechanical barrier down to lower temperatures, the theoretical barrier becomes so massive that martensite should technically never be able to form. Yet we know exactly when and how martensite forms.
Right.
The purely thermodynamic T0 model, the one that assumes the vehicle simply runs out of gas without getting magically bogged down in the mud, predicts the martensite start temperature flawlessly.
Okay, well, if we are discussing the T0 limit and carbon rejection into the austenite, that leads us directly to the role of carbon itself. This is really the heart of the mechanism.
I agree.
If we accept your premise that the transformation is completely displacive, you are making the claim that an immense amount of highly mobile carbon is forcibly trapped inside a crystal structure, the ferrite, that theoretically has almost zero physical solubility for it.
Precisely. It is trapped. Completely trapped.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that it is completely trapped without any movement.
Why not?
Let me tell you why. I find the partial supersaturation frameworks, like the solute trapping models proposed by Olson, much more physically credible.
Olson's models.
Yes. In a partial supersaturation model, we look at a dynamic interface. As the boundary advances rapidly, some carbon is mechanically swallowed and trapped by the sweeping interface, yes?
Okay.
But the rest of the highly mobile carbon naturally diffuses ahead of the boundary into the austenite. The growth of the bainite plate is stabilized by a very delicate dynamic balance.
A balance of what?
The diffusion fields actively pushing carbon away and the structural mobility of the interface itself. It's an ongoing dynamic equilibrium, not a blunt force total trapping of carbon.
It is absolutely a blunt force trapping. The empirical evidence of massive sustained carbon supersaturation within bainitic ferrite is overwhelming.
But how sustained?
Very sustained. Modern high-resolution techniques have shown that the carbon isn't just incidentally caught in random defects or dislocations. It is forced directly into solid solution directly within the primary ferrite lattice.
But surely carbon, being an interstitial element, wants to escape that lattice immediately. The driving force for it to diffuse out must be immense.
Oh, it does want to escape, but it can't. Not initially. And that is the beautiful definitive proof of the purely displacive mechanism. Let's look at the holding experiments.
Okay.
If you hold the steel at 200 degrees Celsius for 250 hours, that's over 10 full days, the carbon remains massively supersaturated in the bainitic ferrite.
Right, but...
If the growth mechanism relied on the dynamic diffusion fields pushing carbon away that you're talking about, that carbon would have easily partitioned out over 10 days.
At 200 degrees, carbon diffusion is incredibly sluggish. The carbon could just be kinetically locked in place because the temperature is simply too low for it to move.
It's not just locked by low temperature. It is locked by the structural symmetry of the shear.
Structural symmetry?
Room, where everyone is standing around randomly, facing different directions.
Okay.
That is our carbon scattered comfortably inside the symmetrical cubic lattice of the high temperature austenite.
Right.
Suddenly, the walls of the room violently shift. That is the Bain strain, the physical shearing of the metal. The transformation doesn't just squeeze the room. The walls shear sideways, forcibly aligning everyone into a single, tight, linear formation.
It distorts the architecture.
It structurally distorts the iron architecture itself, turning what should be a perfectly symmetrical cubic unit cell into an elongated, stretched, tetragonal unit cell. The extreme tetragonality of bainitic ferrite has been experimentally verified by modern crystallography.
Which is a remarkable achievement in measurement, I will say that.
It is. And the point is, you only get that specific stretched tetragonal distortion if the transformation is entirely 100% diffusionless initially.
Right.
It shears the lattice so fast and so violently that the carbon atoms simply do not have time to run out the door. They are forcibly ordered into one specific plane.
The partitioning of carbon out into the surrounding austenite is strictly an after event, happening only after the structural lattice has finished shearing.
That's a fascinating way to picture the Bain strain. I'll readily concede that the evidence for the invariant plane shape deformation is undeniable. The deck of cards analogy holds up, and the residual tetragonality you mentioned is indeed a brilliant piece of modern crystallographic data.
Thank you.
But I still maintain my core position. Simply stamping the word diffusionless on the entirety of the transformation and walking away overlooks vital, complex nuances of how the metal behaves in reality.
I'm not just walking away. I'm looking at the thermodynamic limit.
Macroscopic thermodynamics, like the T0 limit, tells us the ultimate theoretical boundaries, but it does not tell us how the atoms actually negotiate the physical transition. Even if macroscopic diffusion of heavy substitutional elements is completely frozen, the concepts of interface mechanics, partial supersaturation frameworks, and local equilibrium remain essential tools.
Essential for what?
They are the only way we can fully model the physical friction, the interacting barriers, and the localized energy dissipation that govern plate lengthening in real-world complex metallurgy.
Well, I will summarize my perspective by returning to the stark clarity of the empirical evidence.
Sure.
When we subject this phase transformation to the absolute most rigorous atomic-level scrutiny mankind possesses, atom probes that map individual atoms in three-dimensional space, we see absolutely zero segregational drag of substitutional solutes.
Right.
When we look at 150 distinct, highly controlled macroscopic experiments, the reaction stops precisely at the T0 thermodynamic limit every single time, acting as a hard wall rather than a gradual bogging down.
Okay.
And when we look closely at the crystal structure itself, we find carbon brutally and completely trapped in a tetragonal distortion by the violently fast Bain strain. All of this irrefutably points to a purely displacive, completely diffusionless transformation mechanism, where carbon partitions only as an after effect of the lattice shearing.
Well, while we may continue to disagree on the exact mathematical modeling of the growth interface and the localized friction, we certainly agree that the fundamentally displacive nature of Bainite is no longer the scientific heresy it was considered 50 years ago.
Absolutely. The math behind these mechanisms continues to push the very boundaries of material science. For those listening, I highly suggest exploring the vast datasets on nanostructured bainitic steels, seeing how these opposing theoretical frameworks actually dictate the engineering of the high-strength metals around us is truly fascinating.
It really proves that the most rigid-looking, unyielding materials on Earth are actually born from incredibly complex, dynamic atomic negotiations.
And that is a perfect way to put it. The next time you look at a massive steel suspension bridge or the structural frame of a skyscraper, remember, you aren't just looking at a static, inert object.
Exactly.
You are looking at the frozen, structural aftermath of a violent, diffusionless atomic shear. Thank you for joining us on The Debate,